In this lecture, we're going to go contrapuntal. We're going to look at the relationship between the Greeks and the Jews, the Romans and the Jews, and all three with one another. The relationship of the Jews with both the Greeks and the Romans was, to put it mildly, highly charged and troubled, largely due to the fact that there can be no accommodation between pluralistic polytheism and exclusive monotheism. Until the rise of Christianity, the Jews alone in the Mediterranean world worshipped the one God. All other Mediterranean cultures were polytheistic, and as such sought to appropriate the goodwill of their gods by means of sacrifices, festivals, votive offerings, and the like. So there was an inherent conflict, not only in belief, but also in practice, between the Jews and all other peoples. There are many reasons why the story of the Jews deserves to be foregrounded in our course. First, the Jewish experience in classical antiquity has much to teach us about the ways in which the Greeks and the Romans, like others after them, responded to the challenge of coexistence with the people who marginalized themselves from mainstream culture. Second, the Jews were a truly Mediterranean people, in that they did not dwell exclusively in their homeland. The Greek geographer Strabo, writing in the early 1st century AD, asserts that they had reached every town, and it is hard to find a place in the world to which this race has not penetrated and where it has not established a hold. Similarly, the Jewish historian Josephus, writing half a century later, claims, "There is no people in the world among whom part of our brethren is not to be found, and the Jewish race is scattered over the whole world among the local inhabitants." That's because there was already a diaspora or dispersion of the Jews before the one that occurred after the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. The first diaspora occurred in the year 586, when Nebuchadnezzar II, king of Babylon, destroyed the temple which King Solomon had built and conveyed the Jews in captivity to Babylonia. The cities of Antioch, Alexandria, and Rome all had large populations of Jews. There was also a very big community living in the Roman province of Cyrenaica, situated between the provinces of Africa and Egypt. The third reason why the Jews are important for our course is because they belong to that very exclusive Mediterranean club, consisting only of themselves, the Greeks and the Romans, who have bequeathed to us an extensive literary tradition. Whereas there are some grounds for stating that the Greeks were unsympathetic towards the Jews, the Romans on the whole were sympathetic, even though, as the occupying power in Judea, their relations with the Jews were at times disastrous. I'm going to be focusing on two separate regions. Number one, the Jewish homeland, Judea, and number two, the Jewish diaspora, specifically Alexandria, the city with the largest concentration of Jews. I'll begin with a quick rundown of Judea from the reign of Alexander the Great, when the Jews first became part of the Greco-Roman world. When Alexander swept down into Judea, Judea was part of the Persian Empire. On his death, in 323, Judea became part first of the Ptolemaic Empire and then of the Seleucid Empire. The Seleucid king Antiochus III established a charter for Jerusalem, which guaranteed the worship of Yahweh and granted extensive privileges to those worshipping in his name. However, his successor, Antiochus IV Epiphanes, God made manifest, proclaimed the abolition of Jewish worship. He prohibited observance of the Sabbath, banned circumcision, demanded the surrender of all copies of the sacred scriptures, and required the Jews to sacrifice to the pagan gods. In response, in 168 BC, the Jews, led by Judas, son of Mattathias, revolted. Judas, who held the title Maccabee, which probably means a hammer, waged a guerrilla war. The revolt was successful, and in 164, Judas rededicated the temple. It is this victory of Hellenized Jews over the Greeks that is celebrated in the holiday of Hanukkah. There followed a century of independence under the Hasmoneans, who ruled Judea from 142 to 63 BC. We should note, however, that even in the period of the Maccabean Revolt, there was a sizable number of Jews who remained loyal to the Seleucid dynasty. In 63 BC, Judea was conquered by Pompey the Great, who imposed indirect rule on the kingdom, and many Jews were now brought to Rome as slaves. Judea became a client kingdom, nominally independent, but for all practical purposes, dependent on Rome. In the ensuing civil war between Pompey and Julius Caesar, the Jews favored Caesar, and after his victory, he allowed them to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. Suetonius tells us that when Caesar was murdered in 44 BC, I quote, "A multitude of foreigners went around the city lamenting, especially the Jews, who visited the funeral pyre and for many nights in a row." In 37 BC, Herod the Great became king of Judea. Herod was Hellenized, like so many Jews living in the Greek East, and he ruled a Jewish region interpenetrated with Greek communities. Although Herod supported Mark Antony in the Greek War between Antony and Octavian, he received back his kingdom from Octavian in 30 BC. He then undertook a monumental building program in Jerusalem, which he provided with a theater and hippodrome. Its crowning glory was the temple, which he began building in 19 or 20 BC, and which showed the influence of Greek architectural style. It was completed in AD 64 and only stood for 6 years. Pretty much all that survives today is the Temple Mount on which it stood, of which the Western or Wailing Wall, the most sacred place on earth for Jews, is a part. Greek influence has also been found in the decoration of the walls of private houses in Jerusalem, as well as in the style of tomb decoration. Herod also founded two major cities, Sebaste and Caesarea. Both were named for Augustus. Sebaste comes from the Greek sebazios, meaning Augustus. Herod knew how to pay a compliment to the chief. When Herod died in 4 BC, two delegations went to Rome, one from the Greek cities of Judea, who asked that Judea be attached to the neighboring province of Syria, and the other from the Jewish community, who asked for direct Roman rule. In the event, Augustus parceled up the province among three of Herod's innumerable sons. He had 10 wives: Archelaus, Herod Antipas, and Philip. He entitled the highest-ranking brother, Archelaus, ethnarch, meaning ruler of the ethnos, or people, and the two junior partners, tetrarchs, meaning fourth-part rulers, both Greek titles, you'll note. This meant that Herod Antipas and Philip were both subservient to Archelaus. Within 10 years, however, the system had broken down, largely due to Archelaus's incompetence, and in AD 6, he was banished and Judea was annexed to Rome. And this, by the way, was the year of the census that we read of in Matthew and Luke. It was carried out under the authority of the governor of Syria. According to the Jewish historian Josephus, this was when the seeds of the Great Revolt were sown, since the Jews regarded the census as tantamount to slavery. Judea now became a minor Roman province whose governor, a member of the equestrian order, bore the title Praefectus. This signaled that the Romans considered Judea to be unruly, since praefecti were military governors. The fact, moreover, that the prefect was a member of the equestrian order, rather than a senator, was seen as a further insult to the Jews. The Jews had to take an oath of allegiance to the emperor, endure military occupation, undergo taxation, and submit to the prefect in matters of public order. On the positive side, however, they were exempted from taxation every sabbatical year, 1 year in seven, and were not required to recognize the divinity of the emperor, as all other peoples in the empire had to do. They merely had to offer prayers and sacrifices for the emperor's well-being. So it seems that Augustus was at pains to avoid giving unnecessary offence to the Jews. As was common practice throughout the empire, the prefect sought to impose discipline by preserving close diplomatic ties with the local authorities, in this case with the high priest and the Sanhedrin. We meet the Sanhedrin in the Gospels. It's the court before which Jesus stood trial. It seems to have possessed fairly extensive powers, certainly more than was generally permitted to the native populations in Rome's provinces. And as we see from the Gospels, the Sanhedrin could try capital cases and recommend, though it could not impose, the death penalty. Sanhedrin, by the way, is a Greek word, or rather the Hebrew version thereof. It comes from synhedrion, meaning sitting down with one another. A number of other key Hebrew words derive from Greek, like synagogue, from synagoge, meaning a bringing together, which shows how deeply Jews were integrated into Greek culture. The Roman Empire was essentially non-divisive and quiescent. Roman emperors and their representatives certainly didn't go around looking for trouble or stirring things up. And as I said, Augustus seems to have been at pains to understand Jewish particularism. Already in the first century BC, the Jewish population of Rome may have numbered as many as 50,000 out of a total of 1 million. The oldest synagogue in Europe was excavated in 1961 at Ostia, Rome's port at the mouth of the River Tiber. It dates to the middle of the 1st century BC and was occupied through to the 4th century AD. So the Romans had plenty of contact with the Jews on their home turf, so to speak, before they governed Judea. And yet, trouble certainly did occur in that province on a formidable scale, first in AD 66 to 70, the years of the so-called Great Revolt, and then in 132 to 135, the years of the Bar Kochba Revolt. From AD 6 to 41, the Romans governed Judea through prefects, as I've said. The prefect we know most about is Pontius Pilate, AD 26 to 36, who held the office during the period of Jesus' ministry. Four major incidents occurred under him, all of which inflamed Jewish sentiment. First, he set up Roman legionary standards in Jerusalem. One of the commandments forbids Jews from making graven images. Second, he set up gilded shields in Herod's palace in Jerusalem, which again was in violation of the commandments. And third, he appropriated Jewish sacred treasure to build an aqueduct. And fourth, he used violence to disperse a crowd that was waiting to be shown some sacred vessels that had been supposedly buried by Moses. In response to the agitation brought about by his ill-judged and insensitive actions, in 36, the Emperor Tiberius recalled Pilate to Rome to stand trial. When Gaius Caligula became emperor the following year, he appointed Marcus Julius Agrippa, the grandson of Herod the Great, to be ruler of part of Judea as a way of quelling the unrest. Note the Romanized form of his name, Marcus Julius Agrippa. Agrippa had grown up in Rome and was thoroughly acculturated to the Roman point of view, or so at least Gaius believed. He was thus the ideal person to bring the province into line, being as much a Roman as he was a Jew. Gaius's successor, Claudius, enlarged Agrippa's kingdom, but then came to suspect him of intriguing. And Agrippa fell foul of Claudius, who thought he was going to increase his ambitions beyond his status. I'm now going to turn to Alexandria, which, as I noted, had the largest population of Hellenized Jews outside Judea. Josephus claims that Jews began settling in Alexandria even during the lifetime of Alexander the Great, who granted them isopoliti, equal rights with the Greeks, in return for their loyalty to him. And most probably, however, the Jewish immigration began under Ptolemy I of Egypt, who reigned from 323 to 283. Perhaps the most spectacular instance of Jewish assimilation to Greek culture is the translation of Jewish scripture into Greek. It was done for the benefit of Jews who were more familiar with Greek than with Hebrew. It's said that Ptolemy II, Philadelphus, 308 to 246, king of Egypt, employed 72 learned Jews from Jerusalem to translate the Torah for his royal library. The translation carried out in Alexandria was called the Septuagint, which is Greek for 70. Well, the story seems to be basically true, though the translation may not have been completed till the beginning of the Christian era. It was in Alexandria that in AD 38 there occurred the first recorded outbreak of violence against Jews in the Roman Empire. The immediate cause was the arrival of Agrippa shortly after being appointed king of Judea by Gaius, and the Jews received him with ceremonial pomp. Now, the Greeks, by contrast, dressed up a well-known idiot called Carabas, the name means cabbage, and hailed him Marin, the Aramaic for our Lord. Now, then, to escape the consequences of having insulted a personal friend of the emperor, they demanded that statues of Gaius be put up in synagogues. The Roman governor, Avilius Flaccus, felt that he was powerless to oppose the demand, and when the Jews protested, he declared them to be aliens. The Greeks now forced the Jews to migrate to the exclusively Jewish quarter of the city in the delta area of Alexandria, which thus became the first compulsory ghetto in the Mediterranean. They also broke into synagogues and erected statues of the emperor. Flaccus had 38 members of the Jewish council publicly flogged and forced women to eat pork. However, and this is important to note regarding Rome's dealings with the Jews, before the end of the year, Flaccus was recalled, charged with misconduct and found guilty, a fate similar to that of Pilate. In AD 39, the Alexandrine Jews and Greeks dispatched embassies to Rome so that Gaius could hear their cases. The leader of the Jewish embassy was Philo, a wealthy, pro-Roman, Hellenized Jew who happened to be a philosopher. He later wrote an account of the embassy, as well as an attack on the Roman governor, Flaccus. Philo was of the opinion that the attack on the Jewish population in Alexandria arose as a result of a small minority of Greeks who belonged to popular clubs. He believed that the differences between the Jews and the Greeks could be settled amicably and eliminated by each party setting forth its arguments at the imperial court in Rome in the spirit of Greco-Jewish harmony. How wrong he was. Further provocations took place elsewhere. For instance, Gaius ordered the governor of Syria to set up a colossal gilt statue of himself in the temple in Jerusalem. The emperor did not finally receive the embassies until the summer of 40, and when he did, he seems to have used the occasion essentially to bait and humiliate the Jews. Agrippa, whose visit to Alexandria back in 38 had started all the trouble, then wrote to Gaius, warning him of the inadvisability of erecting a statue of himself in the temple, and Gaius backed down. Had he not done so, the Jewish revolt might well have taken place 25 years earlier than it did. When Gaius died in AD 41, the Alexandrine Jews launched a savage attack on the Greek community in the city, aided by Jews from other parts of Egypt and Syria. Shortly after his succession, the next emperor Claudius received embassies from the Alexandrine Jews and Greeks, ostensibly to congratulate him, but in effect requesting him to arbitrate in their dispute. Claudius responded by writing a letter in which he gave a stern warning to both. I tell you once and for all that unless you put a stop to this ruinous and obstinate enmity between you both, I shall be driven to demonstrate what a benevolent emperor can be when turned to righteous indignation. He also made it clear that the Jews must repay toleration with toleration and not agitate for more privileges than they already have. So why were the Alexandrine Greeks and the Jews at odds with one another? The precipitating cause seems to have been rivalry about their respective statuses. In 24 BC, Augustus had imposed a poll tax on those between the ages of 14 and 60, or possibly 62, in which he distinguished between Greeks, whom he exempted, and non-Greeks, which thus put the Jews in the same category as the Egyptian peasants. And this deeply offended the Jewish population, who, as we've seen, were thoroughly Hellenized and who regarded the poll tax, in the words of Avigdor Cherikova, as a mark of extreme cultural and political degradation. But there were deeper causes. To begin with, the problematic relationship between the Jews and the Greeks had much to do with the relationship of both with the Romans. Mary Smallwood goes so far as to state, because the Jews were pro-Roman in their sympathies, the Greeks became anti-Semitic. In addition, the Jews entitled themselves from occupying any municipal posts in the Greek city, because to do so would have implied their recognition of the official gods of that city. The Greek city was just as much a religious as a political unit. All the most important civic duties were connected with religion. So it follows that the Jewish refusal to worship the gods of the city which they inhabited was, in the eyes of the Greeks, symptomatic of their disregard for Greeks as a whole. As the anti-Semite Appian, to whom Philo addressed one of his treatises, wrote, "If the Jews belong to the citizenry, why do they not honour the gods whom the Alexandrines respect?" There was something, therefore, in the structure of the Greek city that prevented the Jews and the Greeks from understanding one another. And what was true of the Greek city was almost equally true of the Roman state, which only demanded from its subjects that they pay lip service to the religious scruples of those in power. When Agrippa died in 44, Judea was again placed under direct Roman rule. This time its governors were known as procurators, though this does not seem to have greatly affected their office. From now on, until the outbreak of the Jewish revolt in 66, there was an increasing breakdown in law and order. Extreme nationalists came to the fore, capitalizing on Jewish fury at the reimposition of direct rule. We also hear of terrorists known as Sicarii, meaning the knife men. In addition, imposters posing as the Messiah turn up, attracting large followings with the promise of deliverance from oppression. Josephus describes these false messiahs as villains with purer hands, purer, that is, than the Sicarii, but more evil intentions. As Fergus Miller has emphasized, the Romans must take their share of blame for the crisis and the ensuing bloodbath. Incompetence and oppression, he writes, were largely responsible for the revolt. By the late 50s, the province of Judea was already drifting irretrievably into anarchy, and in 66, the revolt broke out. A major historical source is Josephus, born in Jerusalem in AD 37, originally named Joseph ben Mattathias. Joseph saw the war from both the Jewish and the Roman side, and he wrote in Greek, albeit not always very fluent Greek, because he was writing primarily for Greeks and for Jews whose first language was Greek. His account of the Jewish war draws both from his own personal experience and probably from the diaries of Vespasian and Titus, to which he had access. He also wrote an autobiography, which was intended to dispel the suggestion that he was the cause in some way of the Jewish revolt, and a tract called Against Appian, a response to the outbreak of anti-Semitism that occurred in Alexandria, in which he sought to demonstrate the greater antiquity of Jewish culture as compared with Greek culture. It's largely due to the writings of Josephus that we know more about Judea in the first century AD than we do about any other province in the Roman Empire. He epitomizes the interaction between Jews, Greeks, and Romans that is characteristic of this period, being a Hellenized Jew who became thoroughly Romanized. When the revolt broke out, the rebels appointed him governor of Galilee. Nero sent out the future emperor, Vespasian, to conduct the campaign. Vespasian began besieging Josephus in a Galilean fortress. It seems that Josephus first made a suicide pact with his men, but then allowed himself to be captured by the Romans instead. He then proceeded to ingratiate himself with Vespasian, who he predicted would become emperor. And taking the name of his patron, Flavius, Vespasian's full name was Titus Flavius Vespasianus, he comfortably saw out the revolt from the Roman side. And not surprisingly, Josephus has been accused from antiquity to the present day of being a quisling, a deserter who became the mouthpiece of the Romans. He didn't regard himself as such. His basic attitude was to keep on the right side of the Romans, and he was opposed to all Jewish movements, messianic or otherwise. He did, however, regard the destruction of Jerusalem that followed the revolt as a punishment sent by God, which the Jews had brought upon themselves. In 70, Vespasian's son, Titus, took over operations and virtually completed the reconquest of Judea. After a four-month siege, Jerusalem itself was taken. Most of the city, including the great temple built by Herod, was burnt to the ground. The survivors were exiled, an event which marks the beginning of the second diaspora, another Greek word, by the way. Although, as we've seen, Jews were already widely dispersed around the Mediterranean. Many Jewish prisoners ended up in Rome. On the Arch of Titus, which was erected in the Roman Forum to commemorate the victory, we see Jewish prisoners bearing the menorah that had been taken from Jerusalem. It had taken the Romans four legions, 20 units of auxiliaries, as well as units from elsewhere in the region, to crush the revolt. Jewish resistance was not finally crushed until AD 73, when the Romans finally took Masada, the fortress held by a fanatical group known as the Zealots under their leader, Eleazar ben Yair. The night before the 10th Legion broke into the almost impregnable fortress, some 960 Zealots and their families committed suicide. The fortress itself was taken by the Romans building a great ramp up the side of it. Otherwise, they would never have done so. It took them some 6 months. And who was on hand to record the event? Josephus, who describes how the Romans heard nothing but a fearful silence as they entered. The Jewish revolt seems to have brought about into the open a latent strain of hostility towards the Jews on the part of the Romans, for which there is no previous evidence. The conflict between the Jews and the Romans was in large part due to the specific nature of Jewish religion. Judaism was unique among ancient religions because it taught, number one, exclusive monotheism. Two, it forbade images. Three, it incorporated a national tradition. And four, it possessed sacred books which incorporated both rules of life and a national history. The collision was therefore almost inevitable, and of course it extended into Rome's dealings with Christianity. Christianity was an outgrowth of Judaism, which borrowed the literature and traditions of Judaism, though it rejected Judaism as a national concept in favour of a universalist appeal. A second revolt, known as the Bar Kochba revolt, so named for its charismatic leader Simeon Bar Kochba, his name means son of the star, broke out in AD 132. It was provoked in part by Rome's destruction of the temple and in part by the Emperor Hadrian's decision to refound Jerusalem as a pagan city named Colonia Aelia Capitolina. Hadrian visited Judea in 130. The name Aelia Capitolina combined his own name, Publius Aelius Hadrianus, with that of the god Jupiter Capitolinus, the Jupiter who was worshipped on the Capitoline Hill in Rome. In fact, he ordered that a temple to this god be set up in the new foundation. He also placed a ban on circumcision, a further indication, actually, of his Hellenomania, since circumcision was regarded as repugnant by the Greeks. It seems that Hadrian's intention was to bring about the complete Hellenization of the Jews by abolishing their ancestral practices. Despite the fact that Hadrian supervised much of the operations, there were very heavy Roman losses, and the revolt took 3 years to suppress. It's estimated that over 500,000 Jews died in the revolt, which ended with Bar Kochba's death. The subsequent decision to rename the province Syria Palestina, in the words of A.R. Burley, symbolizes the fact that the terrible loss of life had finally deprived it of its predominantly Jewish population. According to Christian sources, Jews were banned from returning to Jerusalem. Another revolt broke out under Antoninus Pius, but by the 3rd century, Jewish culture was again flourishing in the region. I focused on Rome's treatment of the Jews both because it is of significance for this course, owing to the instrumental role played by the Greeks, and because it is so well documented. We should not, however, assume that other Mediterranean peoples living under Roman rule were entirely pacified, particularly those who lived on the frontiers of the empire, even if their struggles and the factors that caused them do not receive anything like the same prominence in our sources. To conclude, many of the problems we've investigated in this lecture were due to the impossibility of accommodating monotheism. In the next lecture, we'll see how a similar situation led to an opposite outcome, how Christianity grew out of and ultimately triumphed in a hostile polytheistic environment.